651-6209. Today's broadcast is made possible by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2005 lecture series presents The Real Meets the Imagined, Northwest Coast Art, Claude Lévi-Strauss, and Surrealist by Marie Mosé, George A. Miller Endowment Visiting Professor, UIUC and Senior Researcher, CNRS, Laboratory of Social Anthropology, Paris, on Thursday, March 31st at 7:30 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in Spurlock Museum. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and at the controls this morning is Henry Frayne. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with someone who's been involved with and has been watching American politics for quite a while now, Christine Todd Whitman. She served in the Bush administration as the administrator of the EPA from January 2001 until May of 2003. And before that, she was the governor of New Jersey. She served two terms from 1993 to 2000, and she was the first woman elected governor of New Jersey. She has also recently now been rather outspoken in her criticism of her party, the Republican Party, saying that she feels that the party has moved too far in many of its positions, too far to the right, and is concerned that if that continues, that it's possible in future that will mean a loss of support for the Republican Party and perhaps a loss of the kind of success in Washington that they have had in recent years. She writes about this in her recently published book, It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. It's published by the Penguin Press. It's out now in bookstores if you would like to take a look at it. Questions and comments are welcome here on the program, of course. We just ask callers to be brief so that we can keep the program going and get in as many folks as possible. But, of course, people who are listening are certainly welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are located, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call for you, use the toll-free line. And in fact, if there are people who are listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Governor Whitman, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Is it true I read somewhere that your parents actually met at a Republican convention?
They did, back in 1932.
And that since you were a little girl, you have actually been attending the conventions?
I have been to every convention since 1956.
Okay, so, well, it's in the blood, so you come by.
It's in the blood, yeah.
Honestly.
It's hard to get away from it.
Yeah. You know, I think that in recent years, we have heard from people who've been in Washington for a long time that politics in Washington has become increasingly partisan and increasingly polarized. And although that, if you look back in American history, you can find plenty of times when in Washington there was real bare knuckles kind of politics.
Oh, yeah.
You certainly hear, though, from people that they think that it's been pretty intense. And in, you know, looking at their own political experience, people who have been in the Senate and been in Congress and people who have been around Washington for a long time, particularly over, say, maybe over the last 10 years, maybe going back to 94. And they say that makes it difficult to get anything done. And it also contributes to the alienation from politics that a lot of people feel and maybe disinclines them to vote and to be involved. Assuming that you agree with all of that, why do you think that has happened over the past, say, 10 years?
Well, first of all, I do agree, and that's exactly what concerns me. It concerns me not just for the future of the party, but of the country, because it's very difficult to get good policy enacted when people won't talk to one another, when they actually don't like one another. And it has been something that we have seen, as you mentioned, starting since 1964, as a group, and I won't even call these people, I refer to them in the book as social fundamentalists to distinguish them from true conservatives. Because these are people who have an ever-narrowing litmus test as to what it takes to be a good Republican. And as Ronald Reagan said, you can't be a majority party if you're constantly looking for people with whom you won't associate and with whom you won't work. And the issues really What seems to have been happening is as elections have progressed, the parties, both of them, and the Democrats, I believe, face the same thing on the left as Republicans do on the right, have been focusing ever more narrowly on their base. It hasn't been, you know, Richard Nixon said it back in the 60s, Republicans run to the right, Democrats to the left in primaries, and they come back together running for that middle for the moderates in the general election. The problem is the right and left have gotten further and further apart, and it's harder to get back to the middle. And what that has done is then it's forced the parties to focus on that base and to gear their message to that base, which means it's got to be an ever more partisan message and a message that gets the base excited. And that tends to be, for Republicans, it would be red meat for the red states, mm-hmm. given this last election of red and blue states. And that makes it increasingly difficult after the election for people to get back together. And we all suffer because we lose good policymaking when the legislators or the congressmen and senators can't agree on anything.
Well, let me ask you one of the questions that I am certain that every time you speak, somebody brings up, and it goes something like this. They'd say, well, you know, if you look at the Congress, Republicans have majorities in the House and in the Senate, and in the last election, President Bush was reelected. So what's the problem?
Sure.
Doesn't that say that our strategy as if we're Republicans, doesn't that say our strategy is working?
And I don't say that, I'm not taking away from the president's win, but even Paul Weyrich, who is a very conservative grassroots organizer, said a couple of months ago, while Republicans have been winning since 94, the majorities have been very slim, and the loss of any part of the coalition that they have could mean the loss of that majority. And we are in danger of losing the moderates, who have really been essential to delivering elections in the past. And if you look at this last election, and again, I don't take anything away from the president's victory. It's the first time since FDR that an incumbent president has brought in additional members of his own party in the Senate and the House. It still represented the smallest plurality of any president ever reelected in this country. Bill Clinton won by 8 percentage points, Ronald Reagan by 18, Richard Nixon by 23. George Bush defeated John Kerry by 2.5%, less than 3%. Truman beat Dewey by 5%. So it's not a huge mandate. And if you look at the country as a whole, we are a very evenly divided country. There are 49 states that are bicameral bipartisan. Nebraska is the only one that's unicameral nonpartisan. And if you look at those 49 states, in the lower houses of the assembly, Republicans control 25, Democrats 24. In the upper houses, it's just the opposite. Democrats control 25% of the 25 of the Senates, and Republicans control 24. Nationwide, there are 7,315 legislators. 50.3% are Republican, and 49.97% are Democrat. That's a difference of 4 nationwide. So we are an evenly divided country, and this election did not represent a huge mandate for the party to move hard in one direction or another. We've got to be careful about not alienating people. And right now, with this increasingly narrow, as I mentioned before, litmus test as to what it takes to be a good Republican, we're driving people away.
Hmm. So you think if this trend continues that we've seen with the margins of victory in presidential elections getting smaller and smaller and smaller, we get to the point where it doesn't take hardly anything to tip it one way or another, and you think that could result in one day the majorities flipping in Congress or perhaps a Democrat being elected president?
I think absolutely. And as I say, that it goes deeper than that, though, my concern is what happens after the elections. When you have these extremely bitter and partisan elections and people come to their offices after those, it's very hard to get over some of the language that was used. It's very hard for people to come back together. And when you have a very strict, starting to get stricter and stricter party line votes, again, compromise becomes more difficult. Now, of course, there are senators and there are congressmen who understand that the most important thing is to move policy forward, and they do reach out, but it's getting harder and harder for them. And the American people lose then because we don't get legislation discussed. We don't get the kind of problem solving that we need to have.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Christine Todd Whitman. She served in the Bush administration as head of the EPA, and then before that for two terms was the governor of New Jersey. And she has out a new book laying out some of her concerns about where politics is headed in this country, particularly with the Republicans. Her book is titled It's My Party Too. It's published by Penguin Press and is out now in bookstores. We do have a caller, and I think we're getting somebody else lined up. And as I said, questions are certainly welcome. If you'd like to talk with our guest, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have someone to start with calling on a cell phone on our toll-free line, our line 4. Hello.
Hi there. Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
Yes. Good morning, Governor Whitman. I appreciate you guys taking my call. I'd like to call on your EPA roots and ask a brief question, and then I'll let you respond. Are you familiar with the setamerica.free.org press release and initiative to ask for the $12 billion in funding over the next 10 years to do things such as look at the reduction, possible reduction in gas mileage and so forth, and other incentives to make us a little bit more, less, energy dependent on foreign nations. So I just wanted to see if you were familiar with that and what your comment on that was.
Well, I'm not familiar with the specific letter that you're talking about or the effort, but clearly there's a great deal that we can do to enhance our independence and energy. And that's a prime example of where we as the American people have lost with the partisanship that we're starting to see in Congress. You know, like it or not, the president put forward a national energy policy. We haven't had one in decades. That needs to be discussed. It needs to be argued. Couldn't even get it discussed in the last Congress because Democrats didn't want to give the president any kind of thing. And on the other side, there were Republicans who were split as to whether we wanted to see any kind of more regulations because almost half of the recommendations included conservation and renewable resources. And it brought up topics like nuclear energy, which people don't want to talk about. But we need to understand we're going to have a mix of energy, and it deserves a discussion. But it became all embroiled in who did the vice president meet with and who didn't he meet with. Now, to me, that's not terribly relevant. It's the policy we should care about, and that policy was going to have to have been argued on the Hill. And that's where we need to see it argued. We need to do more. We need to do better. We can increase gas mileage. There's just a whole host of things that we can do to improve our energy independence. And we haven't taken those steps for a whole host of reasons. And part of it is because we have such splits in Congress that we can't even get the discussion to start. And we need to get it started.
Why did you leave your job at EPA?
When did I leave it?
Why?
Oh, why
did you leave it?
Well, two reasons. I mean, the actual reason I left was because my husband and I like living together, and he couldn't leave his business up in New Jersey, and I was in Washington, and we really didn't. It was more of a burden living apart than we had anticipated. So that was the reason for leaving. The timing had to do with a set of regulations that were coming out that I'd been working on for, well, ever since I got to Washington, on reforming something called New Source Review, which I was totally comfortable with reforming, and they needed reform, but there were a number of cases that had been brought at the end of the Clinton administration against some of the worst-behaving power plants, plants that really had been taking advantage of existing loopholes in the regulations and New Source Review and had really increased their emissions into the air, causing dirty air for all of us and real health problems. And I wanted to make sure that as we reform New Source Review, we did it in a way that didn't undermine those cases. But we were getting to the point where the numbers were going to come out and they were going to be set at a point that did that, that undermined the cases. And, you know, it was up to the president's policy, and he has a right to set it wherever he wants it. But he also, I felt, had the right to have an EPA administrator who could sign those regulations comfortably, and I just couldn't. So I thought it was time for me to move on then.
All right. Let's talk with some other callers. Next in line, someone in Urbana, and this is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, a comment and a question. The comment is that you were talking, your basic thesis is that we've got to stop this polarization and all that. But, you know, my dictionary defines a privatist as someone who is noncommittal to or uninvolved with anything other than his or her own immediate interests and lifestyle. And for a lot of people, that's essentially a kind of an adolescent position, and it's completely antithetical to any kind of interest in the common good. And on the other hand, an agency concerned with environmental issues is inextricably concerned with the common good. So I just don't see how anybody can give up any turf on this, you know. Either you're going to be totally self-absorbed and interested in nothing but profit, or you're going to be, or you're going to give you're going to give away things to the common good and be able to sacrifice for it. So I don't think there's any chance of seeing this rancor stop at all, I think. But I have a question on top of that, and that is that it was said when you quit the EPA that in particular this Andrew Revkin, the environmental reporter for the New York Times, that the White House had its own source of getting advice on issues like climate or water quality called the Council on Environmental Quality, and that that they work closely with President Bush. And I'd like to hear from you whether that's accurate, and that they whether in fact they rely more on them than they did on the EPA and the head of the EPA. And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I'm not as pessimistic as the caller is about businesses' ability and willingness at times to step up to the plate and do things that are above and beyond what's required through the regulatory process because they're for the greater good. I've seen it happen. There are a number of voluntary programs that EPA runs that have been enormously successful and have really shown measurable improvements to the environment and have gone beyond what regulations require. And those are the kinds of things that they may not be enough totally, and you can't stop there, but they certainly should be recognized for the good that they have done, and they should be encouraged. It is a way to harness the intellectual stimulus and the creativity that the private sector has. Government's good at a lot of things. Creativity is not necessarily its strong point, the strong point of a bureaucracy, and to the extent that we can harness that ingenuity of the private sector in the United States, we can move ahead further and faster than regulations call for. And we've seen that. We saw that with the acid rain trading program when we provided an incentive for businesses, and they moved ahead beyond what any regulations required, and they did it faster, and they did it at less cost than one is anticipated. So there is hope, and there is a lot that can be done. You don't walk away from regulations entirely. And there are certainly a number of Republicans who recognize that. Don't forget the Environmental Protection Agency was established by Richard Nixon, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Richard Nixon. The toxic waste requirements were under President Gerald Ford. The Clean Air Act amendments were George Bush the 41st. So Republicans have a long history, starting back with Teddy Roosevelt and the National Park Association, of being good stewards of the environment. And a lot of people would say, well, big businesses are Republican, and so there's an overlap there, and there's a lot that we can do. The Council on Environmental Quality was established a long time ago, really when the agency was first established, and there's always been, it's been there, it's in the White House. It is there to provide information to the White House on environmental issues and also to help coordinate with the other departments and agencies, because with the environment, you have a lot of crossover. There are a lot of other departments and agencies that are impacted by decisions made at EPA, and there's always going to be tension there, and there's always going to be pushback against what the agency wants to do simply because it's a regulatory agency, and there are a lot of people who don't like regulation, and every decision it makes requires someone to either change behavior or invest a lot of money for benefits they may never see, and that's tough. And you've got to keep reminding people of the greater good and the need to breathe clean air and the need to have clean water and to have a quality of life with well-protected land and open space. And so there always is that tension. Whether they relied on them more than they relied on EPA, I don't think so. Certainly for any of the major decisions, I was always at the table when we talked about the clear skies when we talked about the water issues. Did EPA, did CEQ weigh in, and did they bring to the table the other agencies' perspectives? Absolutely. And sometimes EPA won and sometimes it didn't. But from all that I have watched and seen of government and my time in and around government, I don't think that is all that different than what you've seen in the past. There have always been those tensions between CEQ and the agency.
Well, just reading about you, what you have read about yourself, what people have written about you, it seems fairly clear that you were brought into the administration to put a good face on things, to make it look as if the administration had a commitment to the environment, because you were someone who was seen as a progressive for a Republican on these issues, and that you were increasingly frustrated and felt that you were unable to do your job, or at least weren't able to carry out the kind of policies that you wanted. And eventually, among the personal reasons that you cited, that's the reason that you quit, because you just had it. Is that true?
Well, as I said, one of the reasons I quit was because of the frustration that I did have and the concern that I had about the new source review regulations and where they were coming out, what was happening with them, and how that was going to impact the cases that had gone, were going forward, that had been brought during my time, actually, as governor. I had been party to some of those cases, and I really felt a commitment to them and a concern about undermining them, and I felt we could actually change the regulation and that we were concerned about without having to lose the cases, but that's not the way it went. But you know what? This is never about an individual. This is about policy that's much broader, and you're going to win some and you're going to lose some. And the forces, really, that make it difficult as a Republican and in a Republican administration were twofold. One, there's no secret that Karl Rove said from the very beginning, shortly after the president got elected, that his focus was going to be on the 4 million evangelical Christians who had not gone to the polls in 2000. And their pollsters were telling the White House that those people didn't care about the environment. So that when we did things for the environment, and the administration has probably a much better record on the environment than most people think. I mean, I know we do because of the way the press has gone. We didn't talk about the good things, and we emphasized, projected messages in a way that was going to appeal to the group of people who really didn't want to know a lot about increased environmental regulations. And that sold the president short in many ways, I think. It alienated him from those people who are moderates or who are Republicans who care deeply about the environment and felt that he didn't. And it also hurt us amongst our allies, because on issues such as the Kyoto Protocol, when we disengaged from it, that was no surprise to anybody. When the Clinton administration had negotiated the treaty, they'd taken it up to the Senate, and the Senate rejected it 95-0. And every year after that, they had prohibited any branch of the federal government from implementing anything, it looked like, Kyoto. So this country was never going to be a party to the protocol as it stands today and as it stood at the time. That was not the surprise, but because we wanted to make sure that the base understood that we weren't going to be involved in this kind of an international treaty, and we weren't going to kowtow to people outside the country who many people feel were trying to influence our economy over an issue that wasn't of great import, global climate change, we didn't distinguish between the process that had been 10 years in the making and involved the rest of the developed world and the protocol. And when we did that, the rest of the world thought, well, you know, look at the United States. They are the biggest producers of greenhouse gases. It's an issue that we care deeply about. They don't seem to care. And they're telling us it doesn't matter to them whether we care or not. It's just what they care about that's important. And yet they're asking us to join them on some other things internationally that are pretty controversial. So, and yet this president is spending and has spent more money on climate change research and technology development than the rest of the combined. He has called for an 18% reduction in greenhouse gas intensity over 10 years. He has entered into and had the government enter into agreements with other developed countries to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and to develop new technologies, coal bed methane and hydrogen fuel cell technology. So we are engaged internationally on this issue, but nobody would know it because we didn't talk about it. We were only interested in reassuring the people who didn't like the idea of the Kyoto Protocol that we weren't going to be involved. And that's one of those, it's those mixed messages, it's that focus on a very narrow partisan base that I believe has unduly hurt the administration.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you, I have some other callers, and I promise these people will get to them, but let me ask you another question. Going back to your initial comments about your concerns about the party moving to the right, particularly on social issues, it has been the case that in recent years, one of the most reliable constituencies for the Republican Party have been social conservatives, mm-hmm. and because they are they're dedicated to the Republican cause, they're organized, they're mobilized, they work hard, and they vote. Given that fact, and given that they have been such loyal supporters of the Republican Party, how can you, as a Republican, or anyone as a Republican, go to them and say, well, now, look, we realize that you think that gay marriage, for example, is one of the most important things going these days. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that most Americans don't, and that we think there are a lot of things that are a lot more important. So we're really not going to deal with that. We're going to deal with a lot of other stuff, like Social Security, for example. And I think there are now a lot of conservative Republicans, socially conservative Republicans, who are really concerned because they feel that while the president has said he was committed to their issues, that he isn't really doing anything about it. How now, given the fact that those people have been very supportive of Republicans, do you say to them, well, you know, we really don't think your issues are very important?
I know it's not a question of saying we don't think your issues are important, but what it is a question of saying we don't hold the president, for instance, hostage on gay marriage or a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. We don't hold him hostage on that to any discussion on Social Security, which is what happened right after the election when the president stood up and said, I wanted, and I think one of the most important things facing this country is going to be Social Security. We need to discuss it. And he had members of his own party standing up and saying, sorry, we're not even going to begin this discussion until you convince us that you're going to be strong enough on this issue of a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage. Now, I know a lot of good conservatives who feel very strongly about same-sex marriage. They are not in support of it. But they also don't believe that amending the Constitution for only the second time ever to restrict individual freedom is the way to deal with this issue. And so it's not monolithic there. It's not a question of walking away and saying, we've played with you, we've brought you to the table, and now we're not going to deal with any of your issues. There are a lot of issues that the president is dealing with. This is the most socially conservative president, certainly in my lifetime. But it's a question of saying that these are the only issues we'll deal with. I have spent a lot of time in this party going around the country working for Republican candidates of all stripes, pro-choice, pro-life, all of them. And yet I have noticed increasingly that those on the far right not only refuse to support Republicans who may not believe exactly the way they do on these issues. I mean, they may be supportive of a ban on gay marriage, but they don't believe you should amend the Constitution to do it. That's not good enough for this group, and they will go out and they will mount a campaign against those Republicans. And that's where you cross the line. It is saying, if you don't believe the way I do, we're going to take you out, even if by taking you, a Republican office holder, out in a primary, we may end up with a Democrat in that seat. For some reason, the mindset seems to be they'd rather have someone who votes against them 100% of the time and a Democrat than a Republican who will vote with them 85 or 90% of the time. If they're not, they've got to be 100%.
We have several callers, and I think I probably should introduce very quickly, again, our guest for this hour of Focus 580. We're talking with Christine Todd Whitman. She served in the Bush administration as the administrator head of the EPA from January 2001 until May of 2003. And before that, she was the first woman elected governor of the state of New Jersey, serving two terms from 1993 to 2000. And she has authored a book laying out some of her ideas about American politics and the direction the Republican Party is going. Her book is titled It's My Party Too, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America, and it's published by the Penguin Press. Back to the phones here, and our next caller is on our line number two in Edgewood.
Governor
Hello.
Whitman, thank you for coming on this radio show. I'm a liberal who's always been very impressed by you and hope you get back into politics on a national level. However, most of my friends are very conservative down here, very conservative part of the world. United States, and they face questions of high health care costs. We saw a bankruptcy bill passed last week, which left huge loopholes for the richest people in this country. We're facing $2 a gallon gasoline or a lot more. We saw tax cuts for the rich over and over again. Money turns over in our community seven times, we've been told. And if that money would have been given to those of us who are regular people, not the rich, we would have seen a big boom in our economy. I could go on and on, but at what point will the public wake up, or is this Karl Rove propaganda machine just that good and it's going to keep going?
Well, I mean, first of all, I disagree with some of the cause and effect. I, as a governor, reduced taxes over 50 times, and we stimulated the economy and saw the creation of more than 450,000 jobs while I was governor. The problem is you've got to control spending at the same time.
Agreed.
That takes both sides, and we've got to really focus on that, and that is a major concern. I put in one of the things I did with the book, which is slightly different than I think many, is we put a website at the end of it, www.myparty2.com. The purpose of that website was to give moderates a place to go, to talk to one another, to talk about the issues of importance, to understand how you can support other moderates, how you can get a grassroots movement going, to bring some moderation back to the political discussion. You know, Karl Rove is very, very good at what he does, and I wouldn't take that away from him. He did exactly what he was supposed to do as the head of the political operation, the political shop in the White House. My concern is at what cost? Yeah. At what cost to continuing the dialogue of getting people back together, of being able to move the country forward? And I do believe that we can have good discussions on these issues, that we will get people back and focused on what makes sense and what doesn't make sense for the future of the country. As I say, I'm not against the tax cuts. It's a question of what you do with the spending side of it in order to balance things out. But we need to have a fuller discussion. And right now, we can't even begin that because people are so polarized between Republicans and Democrats and within the Republican Party. And as I said, I think the Democrats are facing the same kinds of issues. And if we think we can get back together in a bipartisan way, when you have a new chairman of the Democrat National Committee who said he hates all Republicans and everything they stand for, I mean, that's not exactly reaching out. So both sides have to start grappling with these issues, and we have to make ourselves heard. I think part of the problem, and I say it in the book, part of the problem and the reason why the social fundamentalists in my party, the extreme on the right in my party, has been so successful is they've been single-minded. They've been very focused. It's, you know, as was mentioned earlier, they vote, they come out to the polls, they come out to all elections. They have been very good at taking over parties at the grassroots level. Moderates have to start pushing back, and if we really care enough, if we really think these issues are important, we have to start to get organized at the local level, and that's how you build a consensus. The interesting thing to me is nobody's monolithic, and just last month, you saw for the first time some articles saying that the Christian evangelicals have started a focus on the environment, have decided the environment is an important issue and one where they need to be involved because we need to have more environmental protection. That's good news as far as I'm concerned. I am very pleased to hear that. It has not been the case in the past, but that's where they seem to be going, and we ought to work together on that, and we can.
Well, I hope that gets to the comments of the caller. Let's go on here, because I do have some others. Let's go to line number 3. This is someone here in Champaign, Urbana. Yes, hello.
Interesting. Comment, please, on the European situation for examining new products or regulating them, because there was an op-ed article that said Europe has health plans that are pretty universal. One might have to wait in a long line, though. But it has fewer lawsuits, and the loser has to pay, and there's no big awards. The article seemed to suggest big awards in the States are necessary to, quote, curb dangerous products because the EPA could never ban asbestos. Gracias.
Well, can you respond to that?
Well, I'm not exactly sure where the question is. Yes, Europe has very different standards in many areas. I am not sure that I would adopt the European system. I have lived abroad at different times. Actually, our first child was born in England. And while the system is great for those who can pay, it's not so great for those who can't. Everyone gets coverage, but you do wait in line. And what may be considered elective or non-essential surgery to the system may seem very essential to the person who needs it. And just as you look at the Canadian system, it's got some very good things to it, but you also see a lot of Canadian doctors coming across the border so that they can practice medicine in a way that they feel is more responsive and respectful of the patient. So, you know, we have our problems, and I do believe that we need some curbing of lawsuits, frivolous lawsuits, there is no question, but they do drive up the cost of providing medicine. And when you live in a state, for instance, as I do in New Jersey, where we are losing OBGYNs because of the cost of medical malpractice, you begin to see that this is, can be counterproductive. And while you want to protect the rights of those who have a legitimate suit and case to bring, you also need to understand that we are now getting to the point where some of these awards and some of the cases, we sort of have an attitude, nothing can ever go wrong any time. It never should. And if it does, it's somebody's fault and somebody's got to pay. In some instances, that's absolutely true. In other times, there are things that happen. And if you undergo a risky procedure, you have to understand there's a risk associated with it. We just need to bring some balance back to the process so we don't see losing, we don't see ourselves losing doctors. Now, as far as the impact of EPA's not regulating asbestos, EPA does have a lot of regulations relative to asbestos and how best to use it and how to encapsulate it. There is a real discussion going on right now amongst scientists as to what form of asbestos is the most problematic, what length of asbestos fiber. We see a lot of things in this country that we think are going to, they're the next generation. When asbestos came in, it was a wonderful boon to people. It was used in almost everything, and it was only after a period of time that we suddenly realized the problems with it and the downside. And now the next step is, how far do you go? Do you take out all asbestos, never use it again? Or do you recognize that if you encapsulate it and don't move it, that it can be all right, but you don't use any new asbestos? These are questions that are being determined. It's not about the agency not being able to design a regulation. They can. Anytime they do, it'll end up in court, and it spends. That's why it's much better to have Congress act than it is to have EPA on some of these issues, because when Congress acts, that's the law, and you don't have the same recourse to the courts as you do when the EPA establishes a regulation. But there are prohibitions against, or they're not prohibitions, but there are recommendations about how to use asbestos. There are lots of warnings out there, but there's a real discussion in the environmental community even about whether it should be banned everywhere or whether it should be just, it can be used appropriately.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is someone listening in Chicago, line 4.
Oh, yes, hello. Mm-hmm. I would disagree with your guest on her basic premise, first of all, and also her terminology. I feel that it's very important to offer voters a choice. And when you have a situation where insiders are controlling a party on both sides, and you don't really have room for people of ideals, people who believe in certain things and believe in them strongly, I think you have a very dangerous situation where you just basically have status quo politics, and I think you have that on both sides. And I think it's very important for conservatives to have their point of view heard and give an alternative to the other side. I think this is very important. And secondly, on your terminology, when you use the word moderate, I think if you really look at it, it's just another word for a liberal Republican. They call them moderates, but if you look at their views, pro-abortion, pro-homosexuality, this is the liberal point of view. And when these people are in control, voters do not have a choice. And so you really defeat the democratic process. That really should be there.
Well,
Certainly agree voters should have a choice. And I have always supported that, and that's why I've supported candidates of all stripes. But I believe the caller's doing exactly what I am concerned about and lumping everybody together and saying there can be only one way to think. Moderates, these terms are all very problematic. People say to me, what are you, moderate, conservative, liberal? I'd say, tell me the issue, and I'll tell you where I stand, and then you decide. As I say, I'm someone who cut taxes over 50 times in my state. We enacted Megan's Law. We reduced crime to the lowest levels in generations. We reduced government spending. If you look at my record, it's a very conservative record. Do I believe a woman has a right to make some decisions on her body? Yes. I absolutely do, but I also wrote a bill that would have, for the first time in the history of the state of New Jersey, put some restrictions on late-term abortions. Unfortunately, they were those in the party that said, you have to absolutely, there can be no exception. Rape, incest, life, health of the mother, no exceptions. And they insisted that that's the way the language read, and that was unconstitutional in our state. I said it was unconstitutional, so as I said, I rewrote the bill to provide the protection and recognize that a woman doesn't stop being a human being just because she gets pregnant, and if her life or physical health are in danger, she has a right to have a say in this decision. And unfortunately, I was overridden in that, and it went to the courts. They spent a lot of money, the legislature, a lot of public money here defending it, and it was declared unconstitutional. You know, that's where you start to get into the other side. There's always room in the party, as I see it, for people with very passionate and strong views, but we can be respectful of one another, and we can understand and respect that there are others who feel just as passionately on the other side. Unfortunately, what we're seeing today is there's no room in their party for someone like me. You know, the most recent instance, and one that really brings it and particularly goes to what the callers just talked about not having a diversity of opinion, Ken Mellman, who is the new chairman of the Republican National Committee, chose as his vice chairman a woman from Ohio, Joanne Davidson, who had been a speaker of the Ohio House of Representatives, who had been very instrumental in the president's key victory there, and Ohio was key to the president's reelection, but who was also on the board of Republicans for Choice. Because of that decision, the email traffic went wild. The calls into the National Committee, you can't appoint somebody like this. It's a disgrace to have someone on the representing the National Party who believes in a woman's right to choose. And the president had to intercede and had to say, look, this is someone who has been loyal to the party, who was instrumental in my reelection, and who can be very helpful in broadening the base of the party and bringing people to the party. Unfortunately, and that worked, and she is now the vice chairman, but she had to agree never to appear before a pro-choice fundraiser. Now, I'm a Republican. I have been a Republican all my life. I raised in the party, as you pointed out. My parents met through the party, and I'm pro-choice. What does that tell me? That people are very happy to take my money. They love, and particularly many conservative candidates. I raised, in fact, and when I was in the cabinet, I did more fundraising for Republican candidates in the 2002 cycle and raised more money than anybody in the cabinet. I was just behind the vice president raising money for Republican candidates. So they're happy to use me that way, but I don't have a right to be respected for my opinion on choice at the national level. That's the kind of thing that we need to get over. We need to understand that there are people who believe passionately in the pro-life position, passionately in the pro-choice position. There are a lot of things where we can agree, and we should move forward on where we can agree and not get ourselves dug into these holes where we just can't even talk about the issue, and then we lose the ability to discuss things such as talking about abstinence, talking about, and I spent a lot of money when I was governor on programs on abstinence. That wasn't the only thing we taught in sex education, but I said, I'm fine starting the sex ed program with that and ending it with that, because that's the only sure way to prevent an unwanted pregnancy. We put money in programs for unwed moms to give them a place to go and help if they felt they couldn't bring the child to term because they couldn't live at home. There are all those other things on which we can agree, and that's where we ought to focus.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit less, and we have some other callers. I do want to try to include some more. And for anyone who might have tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes, I probably also should introduce again the guest. We're talking this morning with Christine Todd Whitman. She served in the Bush cabinet as the administrator of the EPA from January 2001 until May of 2003. And before that, she served two terms as the governor of New Jersey. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Back here to some local folks, and the next is in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I guess I disagree with the previous caller. I'm a political independent, but when I was a boy growing up, I'm about the governor's age, I could identify a fairly large number of moderate, principled Republican leaders, Romney in Michigan, Percy here in Illinois, Paul Finley here in Illinois, Ed Brooke in Massachusetts, Elliot Richardson in Massachusetts, one of the heroes of my generation for the role he played in Watergate. Gerald Ford, even Nelson Rockefeller. It seemed to me that that was really the high point of the moderate control of the Republican Party 30 years ago. But now, again, from my perspective, it seems like the traditional Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln here in the state of Illinois, has been hijacked by a game of right-wing extremists who are bigoted, racist, reactionary, totalitarian, and greedy and selfish. And I guess the question I ask you, Governor Whitman, what are you going to do? What's your strategy for regaining control of the Republican Party? Or if you can't regain control, what about the idea floated by former Congressman Paul Finley here, who served in Congress as a Republican for 22 years, of just moving out and setting up another party, a third party where you would try to get some Democrats who you can agree with upon and move forward with them? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, all those people you listed are people that I feel represented our party well, and I was very supportive of all of them, really. In fact, it's interesting, today Barry Goldwater would be looked on as a moderate because he was pro-choice, and he didn't believe that he didn't have a problem with gays in the military. But what I'm doing is exactly what I've mentioned before. That's why we put the website in the at the end of the book, the www.myparty2.com, to give people a place to go to start the discussion, to give moderates a place where they can come together and get support from other moderates and start to understand how to define the issues that are important and how to talk about them. The goal of forming the website, we have a PAC, and the goal in forming the PAC is to build that strong grassroots movement that fosters the growth and influence of moderate Republicans all across America. The point is, as Ronald Reagan said, didn't view the Republican Party as one based on a principle of exclusion, that you don't get to be a majority party by searching for groups you won't associate or work with. That's absolutely true. We can't continue to be a majority party by searching for groups and people we won't associate with either. And so we need to start to take some action. The problem with a third party, and it's been suggested by a number of people, because as I have said a couple of times already, the Democrats are facing much the same decision-making. This is the first time since 1952 that there is no incumbent running for either party, either a president for re-election or a vice president stepping up. So it's a perfect time to have this discussion. But third parties generally don't do terribly well in this country, and now because of the enormous cost of elections, at least at the presidential level, it would be enormously hard to run a competitive race without the apparatus of a party underneath you to help get out the vote, to help bring the voters to the polls. And so I don't think at this point it's very problematic. And I'm a Republican, so I want to fight within the party to bring us back to our roots, to those days of Republicans where we had everybody in the party. And the kind of Republican that I believe and I talk about in the book and the history of the party and what makes me proud to be a Republican.
You know, as I've been listening to you here throughout the hour, particularly before we took the last call, I was thinking to myself, you sure sound like you're running for something. Are you, even in your wildest dreams, do you think about the possibility of, let's say, running for president?
No. I couldn't have written the book if I were going to run for president. I'm not in office, and I'm not planning to be in office, so I can say things that other Republican office holders may think but can't say because they have a political future ahead of them. And you don't, especially my party, if you're going to try to run for president, you don't start by poking the hornet's nest, which is something I've kind of done with this.
Well, we'll try and get one more caller at least. Line 2, this is Champagne. Hello.
Yes, hi. I first would like to thank you for broadening the conversation, particularly with respect to the political parties. I'd like to go back to environmental policy for a second. Teddy Roosevelt said that the private interests in natural resources were outweighed by the public interest. And it seems to me that good, sound environmental policy is both intergenerational, multinational, and based on good science. And it sort of appears to me that the Bush administration has tried to undermine environmental policy on all those levels. And with the limited amount of time, I'll hang up and listen to your response to that. But how can government operate on national election cycles when it's trying to meet this broader environmental goal? And I thank you.
Well, as I mentioned earlier on, the Bush administration has a better environmental record than many people believe because we just didn't talk about the good stuff much. The non-road diesel rule that we put into place, the regulation that controls emissions from backhoes and tractors, which are a much bigger problem than on-road, was called by the National Resource Defense Council possibly one of the most important things for human health since lead was taken out of gasoline. It was a regulation, went right to the base. This administration did it. The history of the environmental movement is a Republican history. We need to get back to those roots. We need to stop being embarrassed about it, and we need to recognize that we can move forward now, building on all the good work that was done through the top-down command and control approach that we adopted in the early days, because really we had no choice. We were in the mess we were in because of the way business had ignored its responsibility to the environment. But we now need to understand that those during the course of those 30-some-odd years, there's been a change in this country. There is a new environmental ethos, and we should build on that and look for the ability to make progress through capturing the ingenuity of the private sector and through regulatory work. And I believe you just saw a new set of regulations come out of the Environmental Protection Agency on interstate transport, much stronger than many people believed was going to happen. So I'm very hopeful that there are going to be good things that are going to continue to occur for the environment, even with this administration and with the people that on whom they're focused.
All right. Well, you know, we're going to have to stop. My apologies. We have a caller we can't take, but we're at the end of the time. If you're interested in reading more from our guest, Christine Todd Whitman, you can look for her book. It's My Party 2, The Battle for the Heart of the GOP and the Future of America. It's published by the Penguin Press. Or if you'd like to join in this discussion that she talked about, you can go to the website, which is www.myparty2.com. And be involved in that way. And Governor Whitman, we want to say to you, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Our guest, Christine Todd Whitman, she served in the Bush cabinet as the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, and then before that served two terms as the governor of the state of New Jersey. Programming here on AM 580 made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. The broadcast is also made possible with support from the Theater Council, presenting David Sedaris, author, humorist, and frequent contributor to NPR and This American Life, live at the Virginia Theater on Monday, April 18th at 8 p.m. Ticket information at 356-9063. And that's it for us here on Focus 580, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more news and information coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine, in the 1 o'clock hour of the show, we'll take a look at recent controversies and issues in journalism in the United States. We'll have two guests who will join us, journalist and media writer Seth Mnookin and Dean Ron Yates. He is the Dean of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Let's take a look now at what is happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. Prices are higher. May wheat, 364 and a quarter, up 10 and a quarter. July, 371, then up 9.5. May corn, 225 and a half, up 4.5. July, 232 and a half, up 4.5. September corn, 238 and a half, up 4. December, 246 and a half, up 3.75. May beans, 675 and a half, up 19.5. July, 679 and a half, up 18.5. November, 647 and a half, up 30.